It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. A poet and a photographer have teamed up to explore how the Marcellus shale industry has affected land and people in Pennsylvania. Joya Spiker-Kasdorf is the poet and a professor of English and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Penn State University. Stephen Rubin is the photographer. He's an associate professor of art, also at Penn State. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsoppel sat down with them recently to learn more about their project, Shale Play, Poems and Photographs from the Fracking Fields.
So how did you come together?
Magic. I mean, I'm joking in saying that, but I think there really was an element of it. For me, I was feeling a certain sort of deficiency in my own medium and feeling like the photographs needed something more. They needed history. They needed backstory. They needed description. They needed some kind of way to help the viewer understand what the images were about without necessarily explaining them all away.
Wallace Stevens, during World War II, he was talking about poets who were writing politically, and he talked about the pressure of the real and how this pressure can burden the poem. And I was feeling that. In many cases, I'm really trying to work with the language that I hear or the language that I find in documents, the language that I see on signs. And so I was feeling this pressure and hoping for something more immediate or transcendent or sort of charged, which visual images bring to text, I think.
Julia, one of the poems in the book that really caught my attention is entitled F Word. Would you read it?
Sure. Let me see if I can find it. And I'll introduce this poem by saying that the word fracking is a slang word that comes out of the industry, and it's a shortened version of the word fracturing. But when activists started making signs and sticking the K in the word, that became the standard spelling. It's here in an epigraph in the poem. F word. Without the K, it looks less violent. Water pressure creates fractures that allow oil and gas to escape as if they were trapped under tight regulatory control. Blame the fractivists, fracademics. A bumper sticker claims, I'm surrounded by gas holes. Frack her till she blows, says the T-shirt stretched over a roughneck's belly at the Williamsport Wegmans. Frackville, PA, named for Daniel Frack, Vrack, from Middle Low German, greedy, stingy, damaged, useless. Are you going to say what the word suggests? A student timidly asks. To women, I mean? Frack it, a sophomore explains, is that hoodie worn over a spaghetti strap dress to a frat house, an old jacket that won't matter if it gets stolen or left behind on a flagstone patio, splattered with someone else's vomit.
And then it's paired with a photo of a street sign that reads Frack Lane with no K. It stuck out to me because of the wordplay, but also, it seemingly connects environmental issues with a lot of social issues that we're talking about right now. Was that your intention?
Yes. And it's an old trope, right? The earth is a female body. I mean, that goes back to antiquity. But vomiting and flow back at a gas well is a newer kind of metaphor. And then, frack her till she blows. That's actually a thing that you can buy on a T-shirt or on a hat. But that's where the idea of sexual exploitation and this industrial activity is introduced in the poem and then through to the end. And because I'm here with students at Penn State, which has this very public problem right now with fraternities, like a lot of schools like this, it seems that the poem is asking us to think about these things in relation to one another.
Environmental degradation and...
Well, sexual assault. I mean, or excessive, whatever makes you throw up at a frat house. probably excessive drinking, right? But it's mistreatment of the body, of the human body, mistreatment of the earth's body.
Stephen, do you have a favorite image from the book or one that means more to you or is personal to you?
There's an image that I am fond of. It's a photograph that extends over about a page and a half. It's of three workers. You just see them basically from their, essentially like their calves down. You see their boots and you see their work pants. And in the center of the frame, there's sort of up close because the other two workers are flanking this center pair of boots. There's a man that one of his pants leg is worn, and you can just see where the part of his boot, which is used to sort of pull up the boot, this is sort of sticking out on the one pant leg, and as a result, has maybe over time has worn out the bottom of the pant leg, the cuff there, in effect. And so it's threaded and it's worn, and there's a long thread that kind of falls down, and there's other threads that have kind of just been bunched up. So I think for me that image just speaks to some of the idea of hope, of promise, of the idea of a future, of a steady paycheck, but it also is not perhaps as glowing or as promising as it kind of initially appears. That the particular photograph was actually taken at a training center which run by Pennsylvania College of Technology, where they're training students as well as workers or laid off workers to go into this industry. And so the particular man whose boots are up close in the photograph is a man who actually worked for Halliburton here in Pennsylvania for 5 years, and after 5 years was laid off. And so his decision then was to go back to school, to go back for more training, to try to develop more skills, to be able to return to the industry and get another job. There's parts of the backstory that are certainly not evident in the photograph itself, but it speaks to something that I think is an important part of this story.
We're about a decade into the shale gas industry in Pennsylvania, and you've been gathering, creating these materials for the book for several years. What do you want people to take away from it now, in this moment?
I really want people to ask if it's worth it. Is this worth it?
Worth the...
the expense, the risk, the environmental degradation.
Right. I think it's part of that wanting people to see it, right? Because I think it's very, as widely as this is practiced across kind of key parts of the state, it's very easy to miss it. It's very easy to drive around and have no clue that it's there, or it's hard to notice what's going on. So I think that's part of the purpose of the work, is to get people to see it and to pay attention, to notice it, to think about what's gained, but also what's lost. Our tendency is always to be looking ahead.
Oh, another thing that dawned on me gradually as I was talking with people and thinking about it is how important it is to understand this industry in relation to our history in Pennsylvania. And people who are not transient, people who remain in local communities, have that long memory and can draw connections, for instance, in Fayette County between coal and coke and natural gas. And that knowledge is very important, I think, as we consider the possibilities and the potential, but also, you know, these cycles of boom and bust that come with this kind of extractive industry.
So of just going back to what you said, you'd like people to ask themselves if it's worth it. Is that a question that you've answered yourself?
I guess so. I mean, I didn't enter the project with a clear position in mind at all. But I think the people who bear the burden of this industry are bearing a very great burden. And I'm not sure that's worth it.
Thanks to both of you for talking with me.
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding? Thank you so much for your interest.
Thank you so much.
That was Allegheny Front's Kara Holsoppel speaking with poet Julia Spiker-Kasdorf and photographer Stephen Rubin about their project called Shale Play, Poems and Photographs from the Fracking Fields. You're listening to The Confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Democratic Rep. Mary Gay Scanlon of Pennsylvania was sworn into Congress this week. She replaces Republican Pat Meehan, who resigned in April and is the first woman in the state's delegation since 2014. And what do electric scooters and Canada geese have in common? They both go south for the winter. Pittsburgh scooter rental company Scooby will be moving its 100-vehicle fleet to a southern city for the winter. Find more top news on our website at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence. I'm Megan Harris. The Beehive Coffee House opened at 14th and East Carson Streets in 1991, back when Pittsburgh's South Side was still struggling to redefine itself post-Big Steel. The coffee house quickly became an institution, both for its lattes and its bohemian atmosphere. Now with the Beehive closing its doors, 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll recalls what made it special to begin with.
In the late 1980s, two recent University of Pittsburgh graduates followed the Grateful Dead across the country to Hawaii. One idea they got along the way was for starting a business.
We saw coffee shops in a lot of cities that we visited, and so we came back and decided to open a coffee shop.
That's Scott Kramer. The Squirrel Hill native and his friend, Steve Zumoff, took over a shuttered Southside pharmacy. Hard to imagine today, but sit-down coffee houses, basically ones with espresso drinks, barely existed anywhere back then. Nor, says Kramer, were there cafes where the tables and chairs came from antique and thrift stores.
And I'm like, well, we can use different chairs, you know, and we can use, you know, the chairs don't have to match.
Then came the walls. Kramer and Zumoff hung an artist wanted sign in the window. The result was a vividly colored mix of visionary art, including a ceiling painted blue with fluffy white clouds, and Kevin Schlosser's back wall mural of bug-eyed coffee drinkers brandishing their mugs.
It was the first sort of funky coffee house in the city that I knew of.
Artist and poet Bob Ziller moved to Pittsburgh the year the Hive opened. Coffee houses were different in those days, he recalls.
People weren't like staring at laptops and, you know, their faces all glowing and typing. You know, you walked into the place and it was boisterous. People were sitting at tables talking with each other. It was really a very social scene.
Meanwhile, says Kramer, espresso drinks were little known.
People used to come in and say, what's a cappuccino? And I was like, well, you know, it has milk and it's coffee with milk. And, you know, like, they didn't really, no one knew what it really was.
The South Side in the 1990s had fewer night spots than it does now and more art galleries. The population was still largely longtime residents who'd known the demolished J&L steel mill. Cheap rent drew hippies, punks, goths, poets, artists, and the Beehive was the center of the scene.
It was just pretty much like anybody who wasn't normal could go and find other not normal people.
Mandy Kivovitz Del Favor, best known as singer and performer Fat Mandy, discovered the Beehive as a teenager.
It was before the internet. It was before cell phones. You had to actually leave the house to go find a weirdo.
Like other misfits, Fat Mandy worked as a janitor at the Beehive and its sister location in Oakland, which opened in 1992. She credits the Beehive co-founders for making the scene possible.
They supported a whole underground economy of weirdos.
In 2002, Mandy got married, and she and her husband paraded down Carson Street on a giant pink elephant mounted on a van. They stopped to take their vows right in front of the Beehive and toasted with cafe mochas. Mandy is now a well-known local performer. She largely credits her career to the old Beehive scene.
The core group of my friends that I still hang out with, that I still work with, that I still create with, you know, I met them all pretty much there.
The Hive expanded to three storefronts, complete with game nights and pinball machines. Co-owners Scott Kramer and Steve Zumoff also launched two Southside bars and the popular Double Wide Grill. But the South Side kept changing. Bookstores and art galleries closed, replaced by bars targeting 20-somethings. Beehive regulars got older or moved away, and neighborhoods like Lawrenceville drew a new brand of hipster. A Starbucks opened across the street. The Hive acquired a liquor license and shrank to its original single storefront. But it wasn't enough. And when the building was sold recently, co-owners Kramer and Zumwalt called it quits.
We just moved on at that point.
Old-timers especially are sad to see the Beehive go, but artist Bob Ziller says he is grateful to Kramer and Zumwalt.
I just want to thank them because they really created a great space for Pittsburgh. And so hats off to Scott and Steve.
The Beehive will remain open into January, after which the Heinz History Center will archive the iconic sign on the shop's facade, artwork, and other memorabilia. The coffee house says farewell Thanksgiving week with events Monday through Sunday, including game nights and live music. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. A sure sign that the holidays are just around the corner is the annual arrival of the city's light-up night. Joining me is Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership President Jeremy Waldrop. Jeremy, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you.
So for the uninitiated, tell me, what is light-up night?
Light-up night has been 58 years in the making, and it really is our way here in the Pittsburgh region of ringing in the holiday season. So a couple hundred thousand come down to downtown Pittsburgh for the evening for a whole host of tree lightings and live music. It's a beautiful community celebration.
The festivities kick off this morning at the county courthouse for the first tree lighting. What else can we look forward to as part of the day?
Yeah, so we kick off with the tree lighting, and we'll have about four more of those throughout the evening. We have five stages with free performances throughout the night. We have a whole host of local music. BMI Mellon is sponsoring a new music stage. And then we end the night, of course, with a big BMI Mellon fireworks finale.
And there's a lot of old classics, too. Ice sculptures are often in progress. Food trucks, company booths, the Hallmark Unity Tree.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite parts of the evening. Around 7 p.m., that will be lit up this year. Highmark is also bringing a new laser light show to that display. And, of course, fireworks come off at that time as well. We'll be opening up the People's Gas Holiday Market in Market Square that opens on Light Up Night and goes through December 23rd. Just a whole host of events that many of them have been happening for generations.
And then the Pittsburgh Creche as well, the Winter Garden. Do you think the weather's going to have any effect on it this year?
It looks like the weather's going to be beautiful. I know yesterday was a little rough, but today, calling for dry weather. So it should be a little chilly out there. If you get cold, you can go into Heinz Hall. The Pittsburgh Symphony will be having 30-minute mini concerts three times this evening. So it's going to be a really great way to see such a beautiful space and maybe warm up a bit.
And I noticed the Port Authority announced they're going to be decorating a rail car this year. And that's, I guess, in addition to buses that they've been doing for some time now.
Yeah, if you're the lucky one coming in from the South Hills on that rail car, I'm sure it will be a party. Get those caroling voices ready because I imagine that will be a big hit on the way in and throughout the holiday season.
Jeremy Waldrop is the president of the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Thanks.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. The retail giant Amazon launched a then-unheard-of project just about 1 year ago, dubbing it HQ2 and issuing search criteria. It needed a new city, a new home, for a second corporate headquarters. And with it would come 50,000 jobs and an investment of $5 billion. Then they changed the game. We've got a full crew with us this morning to talk about the two winners and losers like Pittsburgh. Joining us by phone is Robert McCartney, senior regional correspondent for The Washington Post. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you for having me, Megan.
Joshua McNichols is a reporter at KUOW in Seattle, the home of Amazon's OG HQ2. He's also a co-host of the podcast Primed and is in New York this week reporting on the fallout. Thanks for making time, Joshua.
Hey.
In studio with us is Chris Bream, a regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh, studying urban competitiveness and economic and demographic forecasting. Great to have you, Chris.
Good morning.
Plus WESA development reporter Margaret Drake Krause. Margaret, well, thanks for waking up with us again.
Oh, mid-morning. It's lovely. Thank you.
So HQ2 and 3 will be shared between Crystal City, Virginia, just a few blocks from D.C. proper, and Long Island City, New York, a.k.a. Queens. Robert, let's start with you. What are you hearing in the first few days after this big announcement?
Well, there's a lot of satisfaction and happiness in Northern Virginia to get this big prize, 25,000 jobs. There are certainly concerns about traffic, about affordable housing, about sort of widening the gap between the well-to-do and the less affluent. But overall, people are pretty excited and feel that this will help put the Washington region more on the map as a place to do business and help reduce its reputation as just a government town.
Did Washington need that boost in reputation?
Well, the place has a reputation, you know, for being a government town and not so business friendly, and certainly not a place with an orientation towards sort of high tech, cutting edge, forward looking companies. And this, I think, has dramatically changed that perception.
Fair enough, fair enough. Joshua, what about you? What's the mood in New York?
Well, yesterday I heard people talking about how they like Amazon coming because they might make some money off it, but, or excuse me, 2 days ago. But then yesterday it was like all protest all day. I heard people saying that they resent the incentives that are being given to Amazon that could have gone to transit or housing. And they're saying, you know, I heard people protesting in the streets in the snow and saying that Amazon's arrival is going to sort of galvanize their movement to strengthen renters' rights and to solidify some rent controls that are apparently going to evaporate at some point in the future. So they're energized by Amazon coming.
To any of you, what did these two cities, do you think, have that smaller cities, mid-sized cities like Pittsburgh maybe didn't have on the table?
Well, we're not the financial center or the government center of the United States.
That helps.
And I think if you already own a newspaper and have a home there, maybe that's an appeal, especially if you're interested in influencing the larger U.S. system. But that's a cynical view from a Pittsburgher.
And look, these two, the two places that got this are significantly larger than Pittsburgh. I mean, with workforces that are much more ready to accommodate growth, you know, of 25 or 50,000 people in the next few years, even the next couple of decades. Pittsburgh would take a while to be able to accommodate that type of growth.
We also heard from city and county officials that in their very brief debrief with Amazon on Tuesday, when they found out they had, in fact, lost this particular competition, that Amazon liked southwestern Pennsylvania but didn't want to disrupt what we had here to
sure.
just drop 50,000 jobs. We also don't have a direct line to the airport.
Yeah, one of many limitations, I'm sure. You know, light rail lines, access to power centers, those deep talent pools, those are all things, Joshua, that you have covered quite a bit in your Primed podcast. Tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of New York, you know, Queens, and then Crystal City, Virginia, both on rail lines, but not at the level that you're looking at in terms of what Seattle has right now and is trying to make up for.
Well, yeah, I mean, Seattle is trying to build its rail system, and we're not going to have anything in Amazon's neighborhood until, you know, years from now, like 2030 or something. And yet, even Queens is like a machine for moving people around. They just have, there's these structures built like erector sets with layers of transit going in both directions on top of transit, on top of transit. So, I mean, it's amazing, but it's old and kind of worn down, and you know, it snowed yesterday here, and there were delays, and I sat in some train cars full of people who were grumbling, and some of them were grumbling very specifically about Amazon because of those, you know, they wish that some of that money had gone to prop up transit. They're saying, and they're asking me, do you think we could get Amazon to pay for some of this, to pay for a new station or to pay for a new line or something? And I know that there's been some talk about them helping with a station, but in Seattle, you know, they helped pay for a couple of trolley cars, but it's not like they built a whole new trolley line. Seattle did that for Amazon.
Robert, I'm curious, you've been covering this for a while. You know, backing up, 238 cities submitted proposals to Amazon. That list was narrowed to 20 in January. It begs the question, if we were going to put it in New York and D.C. anyway, was it really worth this exercise?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about that. We've been pressing the people in Virginia to tell us if they basically thought they had it, you know, from the start, and it was basically a done deal. And what they told us was, you know, Amazon's being very tight-lipped about this. I mean, they're not sharing information, at least not with us. But what you get from talking to these Virginia people is that basically by the spring, they had decided that the Washington area had the talent, the big tech talent pool, and the sort of quality of life environment appealing to young techie professionals, the kind of people that Amazon wants to attract, and that then starting by late spring, early summer, they were really focusing on, you know, what buildings would we occupy, what kind of incentives are you going to give us, and they thought up until the last minute they were afraid that they might lose out either because their costs were high in terms of real estate and labor, were higher than certainly places like Atlanta or Dallas, and that other, some other locations were offering much, much bigger subsidies. Maryland, right across the river, was offering, you know, I guess about, if roughly four times as much, maybe more than that, in terms of subsidies. New Jersey was offering several times more. So the Virginians were worried until the last minute that they might not get it for those reasons.
Well, and many of these cities revealed their pitches in the early going. Many others did so by court order or by prodding from the press. Pittsburgh, which we'll talk about in a minute, waited until yesterday to give us a glimpse at what they had offered. But in terms of some of these other competitors, these other big, mid-sized, and even small cities that put their hats in the ring, what were you seeing that might have been competitive that Amazon is more than likely going to keep their eye on in the coming months and years? Robert, let's start with you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think that Amazon sucked up an awful lot of information in this process about what locations all over the country had to offer as a place to do business, and sucked up a lot of information about what they were willing to offer. And I haven't had a chance to look at what everybody else has offered to make that judgment, but clearly we know that a lot of places like Maryland and New Jersey, and from what I saw, I believe Dallas, were willing to offer an awful lot in subsidies in order to, that is, you know, direct either tax credits or cash grants, you know, per job in order to attract people. And I think they learned a lot about who had the transportation infrastructure, who had the environment attractive to the kinds of people that Amazon wants to recruit. They just learned a lot, and they will benefit from that going forward as they continue to expand, because they're expanding everywhere. I mean, these are the two biggest competitive economic development projects ever awarded, the 25,000 jobs each, and possibly ultimately more jobs in the future. But Amazon is dealing with, you know, almost every state, has investments in almost every state. I mean, cities all across the country. So they are really a behemoth and just going to keep getting bigger, it looks like.
So, Margaret, you were at the big reveal in Pittsburgh yesterday. What did we learn?
Well, that the year-long tryst is over. But then also, Pittsburgh officials, I think, were sort of upset that they'd gotten so much flack for not, rightfully so, for not releasing their bid, their proposal. But they said, we told you we would, and we've kept our word. So that's something else, is that. But overall, together, the city of Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, and the state of Pennsylvania offered $6.7 billion in direct incentives. But part of that is something that, in our bid, was described as a new social compact. So the idea was, as Josh said, in terms of paying for transit, paying for things that, that people will be affected by, some of the money that was expected by Amazon moving here would have been captured to go toward things that would have benefited Amazon, like investing in transit, like investing in infrastructure and workforce development, but would have also benefited the region, is the argument from our officials.
Margaret, to you and Chris as well, is this, you know, in Pittsburgh's case, were we maybe hoping that Amazon would come in and save us a little bit, save us from ourselves?
You know, Pittsburgh probably is still waiting for something to replace the steel industry, and that's probably true. But I think the point about Amazon paying for infrastructure we need, look, the decisions over whether we were competitive for this bid were made decades ago. You know, so if we want, you know, to have the infrastructure we need, that investment needs to be made whether or not we get Amazon here now. And it will take a generation to get anywhere close to where Crystal City is, which has this infrastructure ready in place to possibly accommodate this. Just going back, you know, the short list that Amazon put out was not short. You know, 20 places. It was inconceivable that they were actually taking, like, it. Bids from 20 different places. They had some shorter list in mind. And what they have learned, we talked about, was mentioned, they learned some pretty valuable information from all these regions around the country who gave up all the information, you know, a lot of data that they're going to use competitively. And that's something I think is missed by this. They gained a lot from this, whether or not they were seriously considering us or not.
We're going to keep this conversation going. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5. I'm Megan Harris in for Kevin Gavin. We're discussing Amazon's rollout of its new second and third headquarters. Stick with us on 90.5 WESA. This is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris in for Kevin Gavin. We're discussing Amazon's rollout of its new headquarters and the implications they could have for the metro areas they've landed in. I'm joined live in studio and by phone with Robert McCartney, a senior regional correspondent for The Washington Post, Joshua McNichols, a reporter at KUOW in Seattle, where Amazon has its original corporate headquarters, Chris Bream, a regional economist at Pitt, and Margaret J. Krause, who covers development and transportation here at WESA. Folks, I'm curious, is Nashville maybe the big winner in this? They were one of the top 20 contenders, but they're only getting 5,000 jobs. Is that something that is maybe more feasible for a mid-sized city?
And so the question is, did Nashville even have to compete for this? I mean, Amazon is an air cargo operation, among other things. Nashville's in that triangle of land where it's the optimal place to support an air cargo operation. And so I think the advantages of Nashville were going to happen no matter what. So I don't know what they offered exactly, but I don't know if they needed to.
And officials here said that they didn't know that that was in the offing, that that was a possibility. And I think there was a sense of like, well, that could have been perfect for us.
Yeah, except we're not that air cargo hub that they are. So
Columbus has an air cargo airport. So maybe Columbus is more disappointed than Pittsburgh is.
Robert, Joshua, what are you guys hearing on the ground?
I thought that they threw in the Nashville announcement because they wanted to deflect criticism that they were basically rewarding two big, rich cities and were neglecting mid-size and smaller cities and cities in less affluent areas. And they just wanted to sort of temper that a little bit by mentioning Nashville, which could have been announced at any time and really, in my view, was not directly related at all to this HQ2 decision.
And Joshua, what about you?
I'm not hearing anything about Nashville here, if that's what you're asking. I can't hear Robert's answer, by the way.
I understand. With Nashville, I mean, is that even in the conversation for a place like New York, for D.C.? You know, obviously they were the big winners in this. They don't necessarily have to think about that consolation prize.
So some things in this list are not the same. So.
Yeah. I'm not hearing anything about Nashville in the conversation here in New York. I mean, certainly in Seattle, a 5,000-person addition, branch office or whatever you want to call it, is significant. I mean, the wages are really significant. In Nashville, they're also looking at those $150,000 salaries, and that's going to be a place where that salary is a lot different than the average wages there already. So I imagine they may feel some of the displacement in a big way, even though it's kind of a small office as far as Amazon's concerned.
When, as I understand it, Nashville's, called a center of excellence for its operations, which would be responsible for the customer fulfillment, transportation, supply chain, which may mean maybe not those top dollar salaries, but more accessible because it doesn't require those software and specialized tech skills that maybe the D.C. or the in New York City area places would need. Again, maybe something that might have been nice if Pittsburgh had known was on the table.
Is Amazon these days all a tech company? It's a big distribution. It's a big retail company. I think the 50,000 jobs, this is a big management enterprise that's coming. I don't think they're all tech jobs coming here or to New York or D.C.
Chris, you study demographics like population migration and reported in April that when Pittsburghers move away from the town, two of their biggest destinations are already New York and D.C. Should we be worried that this might exacerbate that?
Look, I think the fact that both of these locations are the two regions that we typically compete with for workers more than anywhere else will make local labor force issues ever tighter. So, I mean, I think an employee looking for a job will have opportunities in these two locations, and we do tend to lose workers and gain workers from those two areas more than most anywhere else. So I think it's a real issue here. We're gonna have impacts here for sure.
The Allegheny Conference, which is a economic development group here in Pittsburgh, has a report that they call Inflection Point, and we're already facing, as Chris said, a job squeeze. There's going to be a lot of openings in the market that we can't fill right now. So I'll be very interested to see what happens moving forward.
Well, and we hear about those job gains, 25,000 jobs, 40,000 jobs in Seattle. It was supposed to be a much larger number, but that's not going to happen all at once, is it, Chris?
I don't expect it to happen at once, but I mean, if it's going to happen in any sort of near term, that would, I mean, look, these are inconceivable numbers for Pittsburgh. You know, we haven't had a single establishment create 20, 30, 50,000 net new jobs in a century. And so being able to support that would be very, I mean, disruptive, positive or negative, depending on what you would, how you view it. But to go to the potential of a labor shortage, the issue is local employers will have to offer competitive wages to attract workers, and maybe that's the issue. There is no labor shortage if you can offer the right wages, and people will come. No one ever stays away from Pittsburgh. I think we all think the quality of life here is attractive. And if you aren't being able to offer the competitive wages, then you'll be facing issues, but you need to offer those wages.
Well, in spinning off wages, I know one of the bigger concerns has been housing as well. Robert, do you think that in D.C., there's obviously been a big housing crunch there for years. How is this going to affect that?
Well, I think it's the biggest challenge, apart possibly from transportation. And there was no investment, no commitment, no public commitment at all in this deal to do anything specific about affordable housing. I think there's a lot of sleepwalking going on regarding this issue. Look, you're going to get a lot of people. It's going to happen over time, obviously. I mean, they're not plunking 25,000 jobs down in the first year. It's over 10 years. So there is time to adjust. But you're taking the average salary for these people is going to be $150,000 a year. You're going to plunk those people down in Arlington, Virginia, which is where the Crystal City neighborhood is located. And that is going to drive up housing prices and rents in that area, which are already very high and essentially prohibitive for working people, sort of middle and lower income people, workforce people, and they are going to have to commute from further out, from well south of Arlington or possibly across the river from neighborhoods in D.C. and Prince George's County, Maryland. And that's going to exacerbate the traffic problem. And the commitments that are being made, both publicly and privately, to build affordable housing are a drop in the bucket compared to the need. I mean, there was already a shortage of forecast, well, existing and forecast to get worse, of tens of thousands of units of affordable housing. And this is only going to exacerbate that shortage, and the kinds of proposals that are being made publicly and privately to address that are in the hundreds or thousands of units. I mean, the best ones you see would only add 1,000, maybe 1,500 new units when the shortage is in the tens of thousands. So I just think
Absolutely. There's
a huge disconnect regarding housing in this area, and that's going to be the biggest challenge, if not I think that'll be even bigger than transportation.
Margaret, Chris, in our final seconds, do you think that Pittsburgh learned anything that they could put towards future bids? Maybe not Amazon, but a small or medium-sized company that could affect some public good here. Just 10 seconds each.
What Amazon wanted, they made clear these are things that Pittsburgh should learn that they need to invest in now. If we want to be competitive in 10 years for anything like this, we need to make some very significant investments now. Just to be ready.
Margaret?
I believe it's more that it re-emphasized things that officials say they already know, that we need to invest in transportation, infrastructure in general, and housing workforce development. But the question is, how immediate will people feel? What is the urgency moving forward to actually take action?
Robert McCartney is a senior regional correspondent for The Washington Post. Joshua McNichols is a reporter at KUOW in Seattle and co-host of the podcast Primed. Chris Bream is a regional economist at the University of Pittsburgh. And Margaret Drake Krause covers development and transportation here at WESA. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thanks, Megan.
Thanks for having us.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski.
production assistance from Mick Stinelli and Meg Fair. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin, who will be back in the chair next week. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.